Welcome to my talk on our universe, and we'll also look at the possibility, could there be other universes besides ours? This talk will be the intersection of science, philosophy, and theology. Very interesting topic, very philosophical. We'll look at our universe, what we know about it, did it have a beginning, where did it come from, did God make it, those kinds of questions. And then the second half of this will get into the concept of the multiverse. Could there be other universes out there, and what are the implications of that? Before we start, I need to define a couple terms. I want to define universe, dimension, and realm. We want to look at the distinction between these three. Well, universe is anything that's part of the space-time continuum that we're connected to. So any place you could travel to, given enough time. Now, there are places that we just will never be enough time to get to, but supposing you were at that far distance, any place you could travel from there, anything that there's a continuous connection to is part of our universe. The next is a dimension. We live in basically a four-dimensional universe. Three dimensions of space, height, width, and length, and one dimension of time. Now, if there is another dimension, that would be kind of more the realm of what you see in 1950s science fiction movies, something coming from another dimension. That would be part of our universe. If there was another dimension, we would then have to exist in that other dimension as well. Basically, that doesn't really exist, and it's kind of more in the realm of science fiction movies. But I just want to make that distinction because I don't want to give the impression that you can, through some other dimension, go to another universe. You're talking about completely different things. The last is a realm. And the distinction here would be, say, the physical versus the spiritual realm. And that's the question, if there is a spiritual realm. And the difference between a realm and a universe is a realm is something that is distinct from our universe, but connected to it and can interact with it. Like if a spiritual realm exists, we'd be both physical and spiritual creatures and would partake in a spiritual realm as well as a physical realm. And kind of a poor analogy, but it's the only one I can really think of offhand, would be a virtual world of some type of video game where you can go in this video game and go into this virtual world, interact with that, and it's not really, since it's virtual, it's not really part of our universe. That's kind of a rough analogy of what a realm would be like versus another universe. Another set of terms I want to briefly define are four worldviews. The first is naturalism, and this is the idea that everything we see in our universe is a product of natural phenomena. There is no God or intelligent agency behind it. Naturally, if you're an atheist, you would take the view of naturalism or as a naturalist. But there are people that hold a spiritual view that would also take this. You just would believe that, hey, there's a God or a spiritual realm. It just wasn't involved in the formation of a universe or creation. And a lot of New Age views would fit the area where, yes, they would agree that there's a spiritual realm, but everything we see in nature is purely a result of natural processes. The next are three types of creation views. The first is a young earth creationist that feels that a God created the universe in 6 24-hour periods of time. And the next one would be an old earth creationist that a God created the universe, but it did in 6 long but finite periods of time, which would be consistent with the universe being 13.8 billion years of old. Both a young earth view and an old earth view use permissible interpretations of the word yom, that's the Hebrew word for the word day in Genesis. The last would be a theistic evolutionist, which is essentially the same as an old earth creationist. Just the difference there is, how did God create life forms? Was it with an evolutionary process or some type of more direct creative process? That distinction is not significant for this talk. And if I use the term creationist in this talk, I'll be referring to an old earth creationist. So let's start by looking at four views of time itself. The first is that time is circular, meaning that we'll grow older, have kids, our kids will have kids, they'll have kids, and eventually our grandparents will be born again, our parents will be born again, and we'll be born again and live the same identical life. It's like everything's this continuous loop repeating itself. This first view of time, the circular viewpoint, doesn't hold a place in science. It's more of a mythological view. The next three viewpoints I'm going to describe are very prominent in the 20th century. The second viewpoint is that time is cyclical. And this is that would be that we would have kids, our kids would have kids, and then people similar to our parents would be born, And then people similar to us would be born, kind of a similar experience, but not identical. And that's sort of a rough analogy, but that's kind of more like the idea of reincarnation, that things cycle and repeat themselves in a similar way, but not in the exact way. And that time, in this view, that view would be that time is cyclical like that. The third view I want to look at is time is linear, meaning it doesn't cycle, it doesn't repeat itself, but it's infinitely long when you go in the past and may or may not be infinitely long in the future, meaning that when you go in the past, no matter how far backwards you were to go into the past, there would always be a time before that you could get to. There would never be any beginning. There just would be gone. We could go for infinitely far backwards. The fourth view is time is linear. Again, it doesn't cycle, but it's finite when you go in the past, meaning that you can go back in time, you can go back farther and farther, but eventually you'll hit a wall, which is a beginning or a starting point. You can't go behind that. And time may or may not be infinite going into the future. It could have an ending, it could not, but at least it's finite in terms of going to the past. Those are the four views: circular, cyclical, linear infinite, linear finite. The last three are going to be prominent in the 20th century. So let's get to the end of the 1800s, start of the 20th century. The prevailing thought of our universe was something called the steady state model. And this is that our universe is infinitely old. It had no beginning, or if it had a beginning, it was trillions of years ago, not billions of years ago. And that our universe is infinitely large. It just kind of always was always will be to a certain degree, and there's no boundaries to it. It's infinitely big. Now, there were some problems with this, but that was the predominant thought at the as we go into the 20th century. But one would have to ask, if the universe did have a beginning, how would we know? It's not like we can look back in time and see it. It could have had a beginning. There's no way to see it. So that was the thought and the mindset at the start of the 20th century. When we get into the 20th century, two things happen that rock this world. The first is Einstein comes up with his theory of general relativity. This is a very bizarre theory and a complete different mind shift from the thought up to that point. How do you know that his theory is true? Well, one thing is his theory would predict that light would be bent by a strong gravitational field. Well, you've got the sun, which creates a strong gravitational field. If you can look at the stars that are just by the edge of the horizon of the sun and calculate where their position should be and then say, hey, is their position shifted because the light from the stars as it passes very close to the sun is getting bent by the sun's gravity. Well, you can't do that normally because the sun's so bright you can't see stars next to it except during a solar eclipse. The size of the moon relative to the sun and the moon's distance from Earth is just right so that when there's a solar eclipse, the moon visually just covers up the sun and nothing more. So this means that when there's an eclipse, they can be able to then see the starlight that's just over the edge of the sun because the sun's light is being blocked, and they can see if the position of that star shifts until if that light's being bent by gravity. So they had to wait till the next eclipse, which is in 1918 and is in Brazil. So they send a team to Brazil. This team makes careful measurements. It's the stars are shifted exactly like Einstein's theory of general relativity predicts, and Einstein is all of a sudden an instant celebrity and just rockets into stardom. And this theory then just makes the news. One of the things about his theory of general relativity is it predicted that we live in an expanding universe. And this is an idea that Einstein himself resisted because it just seemed too bizarre. The second thing that happened is the discovery of something called the redshift. And the best example I can give to explain this is what you see with sound. If you're standing at the side of the road and a motorcycle or a car goes by, the speed of the motorcycle is significant compared to the speed of sound, and you get the effect where it sounds like yeow, where it sounds higher pitch as it's coming towards you and lower pitch as it's going away. And that's because as it's coming towards you, it's essentially compressing the sound waves, and as it's going away, it's essentially stretching the sound waves. Well, a similar thing can happen with light. If you're out in space and an extremely fast spaceship was coming by, that is traveling at a speed significant compared to the speed of light, it would be compressing light as it's coming towards you, and it would look more violet or blue. After it passes you, it's stretching the light, and it looks more reddish. And what they realize is when astronomers started looking at objects that are far away from us, they were all redshifted. Now, within our galaxy, there are some stars that are blue-shifted because they're moving towards us, and a lot of stars that are red-shifted that are moving away. You just have things moving around. But once you look outside of our galaxy, and except for a few other galaxies that are close to us, like the Andromeda Galaxy, which is the closest galaxy to us, is actually blue-shifted because it's moving towards us. But most other galaxies are red-shifted, and once you get away from what's called the local group, which is the cluster of galaxies that our galaxy resides in, everything is redshifted. The farther you go, the more redshifted it is. And basically what that means is we live in an expanding universe if everything is moving away from us. So if the universe is expanding, you roll the clock backwards, everything's coming together, it's eventually going to wind up at the same place. It means that our universe had a beginning. It started at one place and expanded out very rapidly. Now, this idea, there was much resistance to it. It was a complete shift of thinking for the last few centuries. And some of the reasons for the resistance scientifically is it's just bizarre. It's just a big shift in what people were thinking. So the thought was, well, maybe there's some other explanation for the redshift besides motion. Maybe like light gets tired as it travels long distances or something like that. Well, they started finding other evidences that the universe is expanding. And also the other resistance was when they did the math, it put the universe at about 13.8 billion years old, which is viewed as way too young for the origin of life scenario, meaning getting the first bacteria by some type of naturalistic means, just because all that would have to happen, that just makes the universe would be too young for that, was a viewpoint. The other objections were philosophical. And that's that this idea is blatantly theological. If there's a beginning to the universe, that implies a beginner. And this is viewed as Christian theological. So there's a lot of philosophical objections to this. So this idea for a few decades gets debated. And in 1959, a guy named Fred Hoyle, he's an astronomer, that was a supporter of the steady state model. And that's again, where the universe is infinitely old, infinitely large, and doesn't really change. And in a meeting with other astronomers, when they're talking about this expansion model, he says, so what do you mean the universe just started in some Big Bang? And he said that as a derogatory comment, but basically that term Big Bang picked, and that's where we get the name Big Bang cosmology. It was actually a derogatory comment, but, well, that sounds like a good enough name. Let's use that. So now we've got three views of time on the table. We have the linear infinite view, which is the steady state model prior to the 20th century that I described. But now you've got the linear finite view, which is a Big Bang model, which is the universe had a beginning. But you also have the cyclical view is on the table, and here's why. If you have the universe expanding outwards, and gravity is slowing down that expansion. And so the question is gravity ever going to get to a point where it can slow down everything enough and start pulling everything back together, and you'll have a universe that'll contract and eventually coming crashing back together, which they refer to as the Big Crunch. And so is it possible going to have a Big Bang, expansion, contraction to a Big Crunch, and then will the universe somehow bounce and maybe do another Big Bang? So it's this oscillating type of viewpoint. So now you've got all three times on the table. And the linear infinite view, the steady state model, fits naturalism very well because with no beginning, you don't need a beginner. The linear finite view fits the Judeo-Christian theology quite well because you've got a beginner for the universe. The cyclical view fits both naturalism because, yes, it has a beginning, but the beginning is explained by this expansion-contraction cycle, which could have gone on forever. So our beginning of our universe is just the beginning of the next cycle. But it also fits Eastern religions and Eastern philosophy very well with the idea of reincarnation, that the universe is somehow going to reincarnate itself. And I've heard that Hinduism talks about a universe reincarnating itself or starting over. So those three views are on the table. Well, in 1964, something called the cosmic microwave background radiation is discovered, and that was something that was predicted by Big Bang cosmology. And without going into details what it is, it basically kind of cinches the deal for Big Bang cosmology. The steady state model or linear infinite view pretty much drops off. Later in the 1970s, they do some better measurements of how fast things are expanding and realize our universe is expanding way too fast for gravity to ever slow down and for it to ever collapse. And the oscillating model drops off. So we're really left with the linear finite view or the Big Bang cosmology. And there were still some people opposing it, which were basically in two camps. You had some atheists that opposed Big Bang cosmology purely for philosophical grounds because they thought it out. If there's a beginning, there has to be a beginner. And so that wasn't too much of a philosophical objection. They hung on to the steady state view. And then you've also had young Earth creationists that opposed it because, yes, Big Bang does fit a creation view in terms of a beginning, but it's 13 billion years is way too old if you're trying to make a case for 7 to 10,000 years. So other than those couple groups, people bought into Big Bang cosmology. So what I want to do now is tell you what we know about our universe. First, I want to define a term, light year. Light year is a measure of distance. It's not a measurement of time. It's a distance light travels in a year, which is roughly 6 trillion miles or about 10 trillion kilometers, a long distance. It's similar to the term league, which was used hundreds of years ago, and league is a measurement of how far a horse can walk in a day. So again, light year is a measurement of distance, how long light travels in a year. Our universe, to give you an idea of what we know about it, about how big it is, if you take the closest star to us is the Alpha Centauri 3 star system. And so the largest star in there, Alpha Centauri, which is closest to our sun in terms of size, is about 4 1/3 light years away. There is a smaller star called Proxima Centauri that's a little closer, but Alpha Centauri is probably a better one to describe because it's kind of a more of a substantial star. So it's about 4 1/3 light years away is the closest star. So if you were to shrink our sun down to the size of an orange for scale, where would Alpha Centauri be? How far away from the sun would that be on the scale of our sun being the size of an orange? Well, I'm speaking in Los Angeles. So from Los Angeles, Alpha Centauri would be like another orange all the way in Panama, to give an example of just how far away these things are. Well, how big is our galaxy? Our galaxy, they estimate, has 100 billion stars. Not million, 100 billion stars in our galaxy. And in what's called the observable universe, and this is because we can only see about 13 billion light years away because our universe isn't really much older for light to have traveled any farther. So within that distance of what we can see, we estimate there's 250 billion galaxies, bigger or larger, but roughly like ours, in the observable universe. Something else that's interesting about this is we have the ability to look back in time. If when I describe light years, how far light travels in a year, I talked about Alpha Centauri being 4 1/3 light years from us, meaning when we look at Alpha Centauri in a telescope, we're seeing what it looked like 4 1/3 years ago. We're going back in time 4 1/3 years. Something that's 20,000 light years away from us, we're looking at what it looked like 20,000 years ago. Something a million light years away is what it looked like a million years ago. What we can't see is the same object at two different points in time. We can see what objects look like or objects from different points in time. And so if you ask, how far can we look back? Well, through telescopes, the most distant objects we can see are 13 billion years. That means it took 13 billion years for the light to get us, given that the universe is 13.8 billion years ago. We're seeing what things look like 800,000 years after the Big Bang. And when we look that far, galaxies look different than ones that are closer because they were a lot younger. Now, the cosmic Microwave background radiation, I mentioned, is observing something that's happened about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. So now we've gone back farther. And there's just not time for me to really explain what that is. But that's, in terms of direct measurement of something, that's the farthest we can kind of look back and see something. It's a cosmic microwave background radiation. Symbolically, we can look back even farther. In these huge particle accelerators, there's a large one built under France and Switzerland, for example, that you may have heard in the news. But here they accelerate atoms to extremely high speeds and smash them together. And the type of reactions you see are similar to what we would have seen in times well under a second within the Big Bang. So we're not actually observing what happened then in the Big Bang, but we're just symbolically seeing, okay, this is what things would have looked like then. So that's how far we can see back in time. Something else about our universe is what we've learned from the space-time theorems of general relativity. And general relativity, by the way, is one of the most proven theorems in physics. There's several independent ways to test it, and they've all validated the predictions of general relativity to a remarkable precision. Well, so not only does that say the universe had a beginning, but when the universe began, space and time itself also started. So, for example, to say, well, what was here before the Big Bang? Well, there was no here, because the dimensions of height and width and length did not exist prior to the Big Bang. Space itself started. Well, also when you say what happened before the Big Bang is a question that doesn't make sense, because there really was no before, because time didn't exist before the Big Bang. Time itself started. Time had a beginning, at least time in the way that we think of time. So that is bizarre when you think about it. It wasn't just matter starting, but it was space and time itself beginning. Also, we know that the Big Bang was caused by something that transcends matter, space, and time. And the theorems would say is caused by a causal agent that transcends matter, space, and time. And that is blatantly theological. When you have something that transcends matter, space, and time, something outside of our universe that caused our universe to begin. A little more on the type of beginning of our universe. It was what's called a single point beginning, meaning it all began at once at one point. It wasn't a gradual beginning a little bit over here, a little bit over there, or something that parts of it are continuously beginning. It also was a transcendent beginning, meaning it was caused by something outside of the universe. It wasn't uncaused. It wasn't self-caused. It wasn't that something within our universe caused itself to begin. And it wasn't a reworking of a previous universe or existing material. And also, our universe is not going to oscillate. It's not going to reincarnate. It began and it's going to go on. Whether it's forever or finite, it's not going to oscillate or cycle back. This next bit is pretty wild when you think about what I'm going to describe, but it's the type of expansion. Now imagine, let me give you a thought experiment. Imagine you've got a handful of marbles and you hold them over a table and you let go. The marbles in one clump fall and hit the table and then spread out over the table because they're scattering away from each other and rolling over the table. The table is not changing. The marbles are moving away from one another because they're rolling away from each other across the table. Now let's look at a different type of expansion. This is where you take a balloon, blow some air in it, don't inflate it all the way, but put some air in it. Take a marking pen and put some dots on it, and then blow more air into the balloon. Those dots will move away from one another, not because the dots are traveling along the surface of the balloon, but because the fabric of the balloon is expanding itself. That balloon analogy is what is going on in a universe. We actually have both types of motion. We have things moving through space, but with our universe, it's mainly expanding because the fabric of space itself is getting bigger and expanding. So close to us, like within our galaxy, the motion of stars through space is the dominant motion. Once you start getting far away from our galaxy, because you've got more space between us and a distant object, more space that's getting bigger, the dominant motion is the expansion of the fabric of space itself, as opposed to the relative motions of things. And so that's why that balloon analogy is the best analogy when you think of the expansion of a universe. Something else is a bad analogy for a universe or for the Big Bang is a hand grenade exploding. We've got you have a fixed point where the explosion started, and things are scattering out from that. So you could trace back in time and find what was the location of the start of the explosion and call that the center of the universe. Well, that's not a good analogy for how our universe is expanding. Again, let me go back to the balloon one. But think of a two-dimensional creature on the surface of the balloon. Okay, the balloon's getting bigger, but on the surface there's no point that's the center of expansion. The center of expansion does not lie in the surface of the balloon. It lies within the center of it. So similarly, you could say that our universe is like a four-dimensional balloon. We're on the three-dimensional surface of a four-dimensional balloon that's expanding. So the center part of our universe, where it's expanding around, does not lie within our universe, but lies outside of our universe. So there's no place you can go and say, hey, the Big Bang started here, the expansion started here, just like there's no place on the surface of the balloon that you can say, this is the center point of expansion, this is where it started. Not that I'm asking you to understand that. That's very bizarre, but I just think that's fascinating to think about. Here's something else that's amazing that we've learned, is that our universe is fine-tuned for advanced life, or at least appears to be fine-tuned. And this, where astronomers started learning more about our universe, they started realizing, hey, things are just right to get advanced life. If you change things very slightly one way or the other, our universe would have been sterile. And they call this the anthropic principle, or anthro meaning man. And the idea of this is that our universe looks like it was designed as a place for man. And it wasn't theologians that came up with this name. And I don't know the position of these astronomers that first coined this term, but they didn't do this from a theological perspective. It's just from observations. Hey, our universe looks like it's been designed to be a home for man. And as time has gone on, the evidence for this anthropic principle has grown stronger. And there's three categories of fine-tuning. The first are the laws of physics themselves. I'm going to, in a bit, get to an example of that. The second is the initial conditions of the Big Bang. An example of this would be what's called the mass-density ratio. How much matter is expanding and how fast? If the mass-density ratio is too high, you've got too much matter for the speed that it's expanding, it's going to clump up too strongly and form too large of an object, so it'll become neutron stars and black holes, which are sterile. If the mass density ratio is any lower than it was, it's going to expand too quickly and not have enough time to clump into stars and mainly just be hydrogen and helium gas expanding out. But that ratio is just right to allow stars to form. So that's an example of fine-tuning the initial conditions. The last category is after the Big Bang, after the laws of physics initial conditions, if you looked at all that was involved to get our star and to get our star, the sun, and to get the Earth, every step along that way couldn't be explained by natural causes, but the combination of all those causes are uncanny, to the point that a habitable planet for life in our universe is so rare, we shouldn't even have the Earth. And I'll just, for a quick example, is our sun is the optimal size. If it was stars that are any larger than our sun, don't burn steady over time. They start out cooler and get hotter as they go old, or hotter and get cooler, I'm not sure which, but they don't maintain a steady temperature. And that wouldn't work if you want to have a planet orbiting that has a good habitat for life for a long period of time. You make stars any smaller, you've got to move that planet in closer to the star to be at the right temperature, and you get what's called tidal locking if a planet orbits too close, meaning one side of the planet will always face the star. And that's what happens to our moon. Our moon is tidally locked. We only see one side of the moon. You see the different phases of the moon, and that's just because of the shadow of its orientation to the sun, but we weren't able to see the back side of the moon until we're able to send spaceships to orbit behind the moon. So if you have a planet that's tidally locked, it's not going to be a good candidate for life, because one side's always going to get baked by the sun, the other side's going to freeze. So our sun size is optimal, and that's an example of fine-tuning of the processes to get after the Big Bang to get where we are today. So the example I want to give of this fine-tuning, just so you can see how extreme this is, has to do with the ratio of two of the fundamental forces of nature. There are four fundamental forces of nature: gravity, the electromagnetic force, weak nuclear force, and strong nuclear force. I don't have time to explain all of these, but gravity you'll all know. Electromagnetic force is the positive charge of protons, negative charge of electrons, what make electricity, and that whole arena. The ratio of the strength of gravity to the electromagnetic force is finely tuned to an amazing precision. You have gravity pulling these gas items in the universe together, wanting to form stars. Well, this gas heats up, becomes ionized, and now it has electrical charge, and the electromagnetic force wants to make those things push apart. So you've got this balance, gravity pulling it together, electromagnetic force pushing things apart. That balance is what gives you a star, basically. If you make the electromagnetic force any stronger compared to gravity, stars won't form because there's more of a tendency to push itself apart. You'll basically just get gas. Or if they form, they won't ignite. They won't get condensed enough to ignite and burn. If you make the electromagnetic force any weaker compared to gravity, stars are going to form too densely and too quickly, and they're going to form and right away collapse and explode. Either case, there's no chance for life. The ratio of those two forces is fine-tuned to a mind-boggling precision. It's fine if you change the ratio of those two forces by any more than one part to 10 to the 40th power, you won't get life anywhere in the universe. And 10 to the 40th power means one part in a number that's one with 40 zeros after it. Giant mammoth number. That's how precise that is. And let me compare this to the best example we have of human engineering. And that's something called the Gravity Wave Telescope, or also known as LIGO, L-I-G-O. And this is the best example we have of human engineering and design. This thing cost over $333 billion to make. And that can measure to an accuracy of one part in 10 to the 23rd. So the best humans can do is something with a precision of 10 to the 23rd, where just that one example I gave you of the forces of electromagnetic force versus gravity is 10 to the 40th, far more precise than the best work that human minds and human engineering can do. And the ratio of gravity to the electromagnetic force is not even the best example of fine-tuning. There's other examples out there that are staggering more precise than that. So if you want to study the fine-tuning aspect, there are over 200 characteristics of the universe that we know of so far that are all fine-tuned to get a planet like Earth that's habitable, and this list keeps growing. So you can see why what we've learned about the universe, primarily the beginning and the fine-tuning, is very philosophical and has huge theological implications. Prior to the 20th century, if you go back to the understanding of the universe in the late 1900s, it was problematic for Judeo-Christian viewpoint because the thought was the universe had no beginning. And this wouldn't necessarily be true for other religions. But now we have something that fits that viewpoint surprisingly well, and this is again why this area is so philosophically hot. The Christian viewpoint talks about a couple things: a transcendent single point beginning. And I'll just give you one example of this. Is the very first book of the Bible, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Well, when in written Hebrew only had about 6,000 to 10,000 words to choose from versus a million you have in English. So they use a lot of compound nouns. When you hear heavens, plural, heavens and earth, that's referring to the entire physical realm, the closest word they would have to universe. When you hear heaven singular with earth, heaven and earth, that's referring to the physical and spiritual realms. So Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God's created the heavens and the earth, is the closest thing they could have to writing, in the beginning, God created the universe. The second point I want to make with this is expansion. The Bible is a collection of several books by different authors were written at different periods of time. So when you see something that's written that suggests something, and particularly by the way it's expressed, if you find the same thing expressed the same way by a different author, at a different time. You know that you're not just focusing on how one author expresses things or how a culture expresses things at one point of time. So remember the example I told you of the marbles dropping over the table, scattering, versus dots on a balloon, which is more of an expansion or stretching kind of scenario to describe our universe. Well, I'll give you a couple examples. Job 9, chapter 9, verse 8. This is about God talking about God making everything. He alone stretches out the heavens. Different book, different author, different period of time, Isaiah 42:5. The creator of the heavens who stretches them out. You've got a number of passages by different authors written at different times that talk about a stretching of the heavens. The Bible doesn't use that stretching type of language to describe other things. So prior to the 20th century, other than the Bible, no document, whether scientific or religious or philosophical, talked about the universe stretching or expanding until the 20th century, except what we see in the Bible. And the other exception is Hebrew rabbis looking at these scriptures about 800 years ago that said, hey, from the looks of this, from what's written, it looks like the heavens are getting larger. So you can see why this whole topic gets very philosophical. So what we're left with is two big philosophical issues. A universe that had a beginning. Beginning implies a beginner. And extreme fine-tuning implies intelligent design, not randomness, not some mindless process. So these two issues are going to be a big part of what we see when we get into the multiverse. So if we stop here, from what we know about the universe, we have overwhelming evidence that there's a God that created our universe 13.8 billion years ago with the sole purpose of having it as a place to accommodate man, or at least a primary purpose. But let's don't stop here. Let's look at some other options. One of the options that will have a big play to these philosophical factors we looked at is, could there be other universes, and what are the implications of that? So part two of the talk, and this is where we're going to get into the really interesting meat of it, is the concept, could there be other universes out there? And this is an idea that's known as the multiverse. To enter this to discussion, we first need to step out of the physics classroom and step into the philosophy classroom, because everything here is very speculative. We're talking about areas of physics or potentially different laws of physics that are different from what we know. It's getting very speculative and very philosophical. So anything I say, I don't want you to think that this is established physics theory. This is a frontier. It could be true. It could just be speculation. We don't really know. So I'm not trying to discount it, but just realize we're in this frontier realm that at the moment is all speculative, and it gets very philosophical. There are three different types of things that are referred to when you talk about the multiverse. And first is what's called the level one multiverse. And this is just the thought that there are other observable universes. And we can, our universe is 13.8 billion years old. There's only been that much time for light to travel. So we can only see things that are 13.8 billion light years away. And the thought is, if you could somehow be teleported out there, would there still be stars beyond that? And this is not controversial. People would assume, yes, there's most likely there is. And meaning that there are other parts in our universe that are beyond our observable universe. So you could call those other observable universes, but they're really just other areas of our own universe. So again, level one, nothing controversial. I'm going to skip level two and come back to it because that's going to be your main talk. I just want to mention level three. This is an idea of alternate histories, and this has to do with a notion from quantum mechanics. And with quantum mechanics, we know how things behave. We don't know why they behave the way they do. There are several theories on why things behave at a quantum level. And based on one of these theories is that each time there's a decision that could go one way or the other, basically both histories have to exist. So this means you would have a separate universe for each one of those histories. If any of you read Michael Crichton's book Timeline, that's basically what's going on. They're going back in time by moving into parallel universes with different histories because of different events that happened. Probably more an example that a lot of people might be more aware of is if you ever saw the movie Back to the Future, Marty McFly goes into the past. Before he does, his parents are kind of nerdy. He goes in the past, meets his parents, causes them to some events happen that give them confidence. So now when he goes back to the present, or back to the future in a sense, his parents are different. They're cool and hip and more successful because of the way he changed the past. Well, in that example, you would say that both universes exist. One where his parents are nerdy, one where his parents are cool and hip. He just has gone from one to the other. Now, to me, this notion seems ridiculous, so I'm not really going to get into it so much. But even if that was true, it still doesn't solve the fine-tuning question, because all the universes would have the same law of physics. They'd all be fine-tuned. You're still left with that big philosophical question. So that's level three. Now let's get to the one that's most significant, level two. Level two multiverse is the idea that there are other universes besides ours. We're not connected to them. They could be exactly like ours structurally, or they could be extremely different with different dimensionality and different laws of physics. But they're not part of a universe, they're just something completely different. We do not interact with these other universes in any way, and most likely they're not going to be detectable. I would almost say definitely they'll not be detectable, but you never know with physics. Maybe there's something they could discover, or they could allow you to detect it. So leave it most likely. You'll never be able to know if there's another one of these universes there. And the prevailing thought is that there's some structure outside of our universe that is creating these other universes like ours. And the structure is referred to as the multiverse for multiple universes. The structure is not a god and doesn't have a consciousness. So let's look more closely at this concept of a multiverse or a multiverse model. And the thought is, we know our universe is expanding, but there's this other structure outside of our universe that is also expanding. And as it expands, it creates things like bubbles, in a sense. And these little bubbles become universes, ours being one of those bubbles that are created. So you've got the structure that's always expanding, always creating new universes that also expand. Some of them will continue to expand, others might collapse and go away, but you'll have universes that are being formed. These universes could be like ours, they could be very different. And there's different multiverse models. Are these things true? Is there any way to test it? Well, based on the models, most of the models would have a certain requirement in what's called the curvature of space. And we don't have the technology to really measure that to the precision needed to say, hey, are these models valid? We could in the near future with some new satellites that are going to be launched that can make sort of more precise measurements. They couldn't really prove a multiverse, but they could potentially rule out a big portion of the thought along this lines or a big portion of the model. So kind of it's more like a scientific stay tuned. But the existence of a multiverse, okay, if this thing exists, has strong philosophical implications, and we're going to get to those. But what I don't want to imply is that the multiverse was dreamed up as a way to account for a universe without there being a God. So if we were to take the philosophical implications or theological implications completely off the table and say, are there any reasons out there to suggest that a multiverse exists? Well, there are some things that suggest it or at least fit that. And one is something called inflationary Big Bang models. Well, when our universe started with the Big Bang, our universe started expanding. Astrophysicists feel that in the very early moments of expansion, there's a period where the universe all of a sudden expanded faster than the speed of light for a short period of time and then slowed down again. And we're talking just a sliver of a second here. How they think this, I don't even understand, but it's not significant to get into that yet. But they call that period of rapid expansion that exceeds the speed of light inflation. And so you've got the distinction between the word expansion versus inflation. Inflation is just that very rapid period of the expansion. So inflationary Big Bang models have that period where expanded for a short time faster than the speed of light. And that is making them think that there's this other, could be another structure there, which is, as I talked about, creating bubbles. Those would be the periods of inflation where these bubbles would be created. It's very speculative, but it does kind of you know, okay, that's an idea. You know, that possibly works. Another thing is string theory. String theory is a very speculative theory, and it allows for the possibility of other laws of physics that could exist that would still fit string theory. So if you had other universes with different laws of physics, that would still fit with string theory. It doesn't predict these. They just kind of fit with it. So if there is a multiverse, it does, you know, in some ways kind of fit with some of the things that we know. You know, it's not you would have some reasons to consider that other than the philosophical ones. Something else I want to point out, is there any theological opposition to a multiverse, at least from a Judeo-Christian view? And a Judeo-Christian view would be indifferent. You know, it's there are other planets were discovered. That doesn't really threaten Judeo-Christian view. The fact that we centuries ago learned that other stars are basically something similar to our sun, well, okay, you can accept that. And so if there's another universe, it's kind of spiritually indifferent. In fact, Christianity is at minimum a two-universe and a spiritual realm model. And you've got, naturally, our universe, but you've also have a spiritual realm. So it talks about things be outside of our universe. Plus, if you look at what happens in the what's called the end times in the book of Revelation, it talks about our universe or our heavens and earth going away and a new heavens and earth showing up. So it basically describes a new universe being created and ours is going away. So in a sense, you've got a two-universe model plus a spiritual realm. So something like a multiverse would kind of fit comfortably in with Christian theology in a sense. There's nothing threatening about that. So the philosophical issue here is not whether a multiverse exists. That could fit well for the atheist. It could fit well for the theist. The philosophical issue is, if a multiverse does exist, does its existence offer sufficient explanatory power to explain the existence of our universe without the need for a creator? Specifically, could a multiverse scenario give a sufficient cause for a universe, for the beginning of a universe, we don't need a divine beginner, and could it explain the fine-tuning of our universe somehow? So that's what we're going to look at. I want to mention something that's food for thought. Okay, let's talk about the supernatural. Anything in our universe is called nature. So anything outside of our universe is the supernatural. It's not part of nature. A multiverse would lie outside of our universe, or it's then in the supernatural, because it's not in our nature, it's in the supernatural. So as astrophysicists contemplate the existence of a multiverse, they're basically saying that now the study of the supernatural is now an active part of science. So if you buy into this line of thinking, okay, scientists don't question the existence of the supernatural. They're just questioning its characteristics. Is it something random and mindless as the multiverse? Or is it something with creative power and a consciousness and a plan such as God, or both? So the question now is, what is the supernatural like? Not, does it exist? So here's something else that's fascinating if you think about it. If a God exists, or if a multiverse exists, okay, they are both beyond our ability to directly measure or test. Is there any scientific evidence for either of them? Or this is like asking, is there scientific evidence for the supernatural? Both the theist and the atheist would say yes, there is scientific evidence. In fact, some atheists have said that if our universe is the only universe, then there is a God. There is either a God or a vast number of other universes out there, and they're all sterile. Now, we're going to get into why they would say something like this. But let's look again at these two issues and see how a multiverse could impact it, the two issues being the beginning for our universe and the fine-tuning that we see. So let's start with the beginning issue. Both the atheist and the theist would agree that our universe's beginning is evidence for something that is beyond nature, something outside of our universe that caused it to come into existence. The theist would say that the beginning is evidence for a God with creative power to create something like this, a God that transcends our universe. The atheist would say that the beginning is evidence for a multiverse structure that is creating other universes. Now let's look at the fine-tuning issue. The theist would say that is evidence of intelligent design, that the fine-tuning we see is our universe is designed by an intelligent creator with a purpose of a home for humanity. The atheist would say the fine-tuning is not intelligent design, but an apparent design from a vast universe. Now, this last comment is what I want to dive into here. What do you mean by apparent design? Let's want to explain apparent design versus intelligent design. Supposing I want to compare the combination to a safe versus a lottery ticket. Supposing somebody gives me a slip of paper that has a set of numbers on it, and I go up to a safe and dial that in on the combination lock on the safe, and the safe opens, I would say, hey, this paper was the right combination. It must have come from an intelligent mind to know that what the combination was to open that safe. And I get a lot of money because I've opened the safe. Well, another paper that could get me a lot of money is a lottery ticket. Okay, supposing that I have a lottery ticket and I take this, and it has a number on it, take it to a lottery place, and it's a winning ticket, and I get a large amount of money, okay? That also is worth a lot, got me a lot of money, but it's not, that ticket wasn't intelligently designed. So if I have a winning lottery ticket, it's just because I was lucky to have the ticket that had the right combination of numbers, and there are a huge number of people out there with losing lottery tickets that lost the lottery. I just feel like this was designed because I'm just the lucky one to have the right ticket. All the other people wouldn't have any sense of any design at all because their ticket was worthless. So a winning lottery ticket, or if you have a winning lottery ticket, that's evidence that there must be a lot of losing tickets out there in order for you to be lucky enough to have the one that was the winning one. Because if there's only one ticket made, the odds would be too ridiculous that it happened to be the winning one. There has to be a lot of other losing tickets out there. Where a losing lottery ticket isn't really evidence for any other tickets at all, because if only one lottery ticket was made, it would almost certainly be a losing ticket. But it's the winning one that says, hey, to get something this precise that's not intelligently designed but apparently designed, you have to have this vast lottery with all these other tickets that weren't the winning numbers. So there it is. Is our universe a lock combination or a winning lottery ticket? The theist would say the combination. The theist would say our universe, whether or not there are other universes out there, it doesn't matter. But if you look at the precision of design in our universe, it has to be intelligent design. Our universe was designed for life with a purpose. The atheist would say this, that a multiverse randomly creates a huge number of other universes with different laws of physics and different dimensionality, just like a lottery machine that randomly creates lottery tickets. We won the multiverse lottery by happening to be in the one universe that can support life. What looks like intelligent design is actually apparent design because we just happen to have the winning universe, just like a winning lottery ticket. And there's got to be a vast number of other universes out there that are all sterile, just like there'd have to be a vast number of lottery tickets. And that's why atheists have made that statement that if ours is the only universe, then there's a God. There is either a God or a vast number of universes out there that are all sterile. So you're left with basically three options. First is that there is a God beyond our universe that created our universe. There could be other universes, but ours was created, it had a beginning, and is created with a purpose, an intelligence behind it, and is designed for life. The second option is there is no God or creative mind responsible for our universe. Beyond our universe is a multi-universe structure that we can't identify. This multi-universe caused our universe to begin and randomly made other universes, and what we think is intelligent design in the universe is just apparent design for life, because just like a winning lottery ticket, we're lucky enough to be in the right universe. And the third thing is that there is nothing beyond our universe, and that's really not an option, because you're not able to explain the beginning, the cause of the beginning, or the fine-tuning that we see. So it's really the one and two. So what is the best explanation? I take a theistic view to this and see that as a best explanation, and here's five reasons why. If there is a multiverse and it is expanding, then it must also have a beginning. The space-time theorems that we're looking at in physics that require our universe because it's expanding to have a beginning would also require an expanding multiverse structure to have a beginning. So the existence of a multiverse does not eliminate the beginning problem that we see with Big Bang cosmology of what caused the Big Bang. It just pushes it up one level. You're left with the question, who created the multiverse? And a requirement for a beginner. Second point is a random, mindless multiverse structure creating our universe a sufficient explanation for what we see, particularly for things that are non-physical. For example, where did consciousness come from? If the multiverse is not consciousness, how could we have consciousness? How can something mindful come from that which has no mind? For example, we can understand the laws of physics, but the laws of physics can't understand us. With causality, an effect can't be greater than its cause. Well, if we can understand our cause, it can't understand us. Does that make us greater than our cause? Could the mindless multiverse explain the existence of logic or the rules of mathematics? So you have a hard time explaining these issues, particularly the consciousness issue. The third point, a naturalist view to use a multiverse to explain away design puts a huge constraint on what the multiverse must be like. A multiverse must provide sufficient diversity in the universes it creates to represent all physical laws, all constants, all dimensionality, and all initial conditions. So you're saying that if there's a multiverse, for a naturalist view, it has to be this way. It has to have create all these different kinds of things. Who's to say? Who's to say if there's a multiverse out there, it just doesn't make more universes like ours? How do we know they all have to be different? So to fit a naturalistic view, you have to have very tight constraints on what that multiverse looks like. Fourth point, the fine-tuning that we see is so extreme, you kind of have to have infinity in there to explain it away. And I told you about just that one example of the electromagnetic force versus gravity force that is fine-tuned to one part in 10 to the 40th. Well, if no matter how infinitesimally small a probability is, if you have an infinite number of something, you're going to have that occurring someplace. So really, if you look at the fine-tuning, you kind of have to have an infinity in there. You could explain away the fine-tuning of why we're the right planet, around the right sun, around the right galaxy, by making our universe infinitely large. Okay, but that still can't explain why we have the right laws of physics. So there you would have to have really an infinite number of universes like ours essentially created to get something that is so precise like this to show up just randomly just once. So you could explain that by saying, well, maybe the multiverse is infinite. Once you go there and once you put an infinity in the equation, you open up the door for a lot of implications. About 5 years ago, a couple friends and I did this four-day hike ending at Machu Picchu in Peru. And if you don't know what Machu Picchu is, think of the Great Wall of China or the Great Pyramids. And here I get to this Incan ruin way up in the Andes, and I marveled at the design of this thing. But how do I know that Machu Picchu was really designed by Incans? How do I know that it was designed by humans? We don't know everything there is to know about glaciers. Maybe glaciers, the way they freeze and retreat or whatever, cause rocks to form to look like that, and they just happen to look like ruins that would have been designed by a civilization. Now, if that possibility is even infinitesimally possible, even if it's extremely unlikely, if we have an infinite number of universes, we're all going to also going to have an infinite number of planets like Earth. Maybe I'm just lucky enough to be in the planet where the glaciers happened to form something that looked like Machu Picchu. And I just think, oh, wow, this is just so precise. It had to be made by civilization. So once you go with an infinity to explain away the design of the universe, you would have to then question anything else that we attribute design to. The last point I'd like to make, the fifth point, why we take a theistic view, is if there is something above our universe, another level called the multiverse, then it probably also is fine-tuned. And rather than somehow being able to explain away the fine-tuning, it just might make the fine-tuning problem harder for the naturalist. If we look at the history of astronomy over the last 500 years, every new volume element we've discovered has made the fine-tuning argument stronger. Well, first we thought, okay, well, maybe Earth is, you know, the only planet like this, and we had these things called planets orbiting around. We didn't know what we were. Well, we later discover, hey, they're kind of larger bodies, probably something like Earth. Well, then how do we know Earth is special if there are other planets? Well, when we start learning about other planets, we see they're vastly different from Earth, and we see what makes Earth special. Similar type of thing with stars. We realize that, okay, stars are actually other things like our sun. So we think our sun's special. Well, no, there's a lot of things out there. Then, you know, life must be plentiful. Well, once we start learning more things about our sun, we realize how fine-tuned our sun is. And by the way, we've been able to get good measurements on a couple million stars by now. We have yet to find a twin for our sun. Other stars have twins, meaning there's a star here and there's another one just like it someplace else. I'm not talking to like a twin or binary star situation, but just where you'll see one star, you'll see something else just like it someplace else. Our sun does not have a twin that we found. We found some close, but not quite. So we find that our sun is very special. We also find out that we're part of a big galaxy and there's other galaxies out there. Maybe you get enough galaxies that'll explain away the fine tuning. Well, we start looking at galaxies, we're realizing our galaxy is very precise in order to have a place for a hospitable planet. And we haven't found another galaxy just like ours. We realize galaxies now reside in clusters. We see some things that are very specific about our galaxy cluster. So we're in the right planet, around the right star, with the right complement of other planets, in the right galaxy, in the right part of the galaxy that's in the right galaxy cluster. Every time we learn a new volume element, it's made the fine-tuning issue argument that much more strong. And so if you go by that history, if we do discover some other layer above ours, it's probably also going to be fine-tuned. I can't see how all of a sudden we can find something that can, well, then explain away all this fine-tuning. So that concludes our talk. Sorry it's a little long, but it's just as a big topic. I just want to leave you with a couple things. This is fascinating stuff. I know it's way out there conceptually and kind of mind-boggling, but I think it's fascinating stuff. But give yourself time to think this topic over. Ponder this thing. You know, think about this. Think it over. Don't rush to any conclusions here. There's a lot to dwell on. Also, don't abandon this topic. Don't just listen to this and say, well, that was interesting, and kind of forget about it. No, I've raised some interesting philosophical points here that require some thought. And the science, the astronomy, raises those points and requires some thought. So ponder this. Don't just let this go in one ear and out the other. Also, give yourself the freedom to think about this. Don't put constraints on your mind. Don't put intellectual constraints on regarding what you can conclude on this, what's appropriate to conclude and what isn't. But give yourself the intellectual freedom to let what I presented think about you and research these things some more if you like. So thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this, and I wish you the best on your journey.